This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
Somaliland holds a key location coveted by global powers. Israel, with its lack of strategic depth, sees Somaliland as a perfect place to counter Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen.
An Israeli military base in Somaliland, a secessionist state within Somalia, could cause tensions to explode in the West Asian North African strategic theater.
They are taking money from the most vulnerable, taking their health care, taking Medicaid, and delivering hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, ultimately billions of dollars, to a billionaire.
Washington, D.C. journalist Pete Tucker discusses prosecutorial overreach and a scheme to make the city's taxpayers subsidize a new football stadium for the billionaire owner of the Washington Commanders.
We have been able to detect products of nuclear fission, and they are detected in current and childhood residents who are living within the half-mile perimeter of the base.
The Navy plans to demolish radioactive buildings in San Francisco's Hunters Point neighborhood. We hear from a doctor who has found alarming contaminants in the bodies of residents and workers.
It's difficult. It's difficult. And they're doing all sorts of these things to crush morale. So even when they're not giving you cuts, shutting down your building, they're still making you want to quit every single day.
As the Bureau of Labor Statistics is under attack by the Trump administration, a BLS worker speaks out. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Israel wants a military base on the Gulf of Aden coast of Somaliland, a secessionist state within Somalia, so as to project power in the Red Sea region. Horn of Africa geopolitical analyst DJ Bwakali argues that this would drag Somaliland into the Israel-Iran conflict and cause regional tensions to explode.
Israel is salivating over Somaliland. They want to build a military base there. The United Arab Emirates, which already has a military base in Somaliland, is shepherding this deal due to a variety of geopolitical and economic reasons. Positioned perfectly along the Gulf of Aden near the Bab al-Mandab Strait, Somaliland holds a key location coveted by global powers. Israel, with its lack of strategic depth, sees Somaliland as a perfect place to counter Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen and expand its influence across the Horn of Africa. But there's a massive catch. Somaliland would be inviting chaos by allowing Israel to establish a military base on its soil. First, regional tensions will explode. If Somaliland aligns with Israel, it effectively joins the Israel-Iran proxy war. Iran-backed Houthis, already entrenched in Yemen, will see Somaliland as an enemy outpost. Strikes, sabotage, and militant attacks would follow. Somaliland's current peace would be shattered, and its role as a stable, independent region could be consumed by the broader Israeli-Iran conflict. Regional powers like Saudi Arabia and Turkey might also see Somaliland as part of a power struggle, further destabilizing not just Somaliland, but the entire Horn of Africa region. Second, internal unrest would be almost guaranteed. Somaliland's population is predominantly Muslim, many with deep sympathies for the Palestinian cause. Israel's recent military actions in Gaza and Lebanon have inflamed these sentiments globally. Hosting an Israel military base would be seen as a betrayal, sparking protests and potentially fueling radicalization. The government's credibility would be on the line, with domestic opposition likely to grow louder and more disruptive. Third, Somaliland's sovereignty would be at risk. While Israeli recognition and investments in exchange of a military base might seem like a sweet deal, it comes with strings attached. A military base is not just a security foothold, it's a long-term commitment that would tie Somaliland's foreign policy to Israeli and UAE interests. Over time, this would undermine Somaliland's independence, dragging it into conflicts it has no control over. Instead of pursuing its own diplomatic course, Somaliland would become a pawn in the wider geopolitical chessboard. Somaliland cannot afford to expose itself and the Horn of Africa to unpredictable security storms. The cost of allowing an Israeli military base far outweigh any potential short-term gains. Somaliland should protect its peace, stability, and sovereignty by saying no to an Israeli military base.
That was Horn of Africa geopolitical analyst DJ Bokale on why Somaliland should not allow Israel to build a military base on its Gulf of Aden coast. That was Soweto Blues by Miriam Makeba. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Next, Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke concludes his interview of DC-based freelance journalist Pete Tucker about prosecutorial witch hunts in the Washington, D.C. area. They also discuss a proposal that D.C. taxpayers subsidize construction of a stadium for the Washington Commanders football team owned by billionaire Josh Harris.
You've written for some time now about the awesome and fearsome powers of prosecutors, especially federal ones, to target public officials and others using personal mortgage loan applications as potentially fertile investigative ground. How does the term headshot link to this? And tell our nationwide listeners its connection to our regional history here in the Mid-Atlantic, specifically writer and TV producer David Simon, Baltimore, and the hit series The Wire.
Fans of The Wire will be familiar with the headshot. I think it's the fictional state senator's name is Clay Davis, who's a interesting and flamboyant character. And Detective Lester Freeman, I think is his name, wants to get him, but they're unable to get him. So what they do is, and by the way, David Simon, the creator of The Wire, is a former Baltimore Sun reporter, a crime reporter.
Yes. So
he's using his experience reporting to bring this narrative. But the way they get Clay Davis is to look into his personal loan documents. And there's a 30-year penalty on the books, where if you mislead on your loan documents, and a lot of people do when they get a loan, maybe from their parents to buy their first house, that's actually not their income. So like, but if you declare it as such, like this is a penalty, you can be penalized up to, you know, 30 years in jail. So if you are a prosecutor and you want to get an official and you can't get them for public corruption, then you go deep into their personal financial history, and particularly those loan documents. And in the DC region, in real life, so moving from The Wire to real life, actually, we could just stay in Baltimore, where most recently the Baltimore State's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, who came to fame, national attention, when she prosecuted the police officers and charged them with killing Freddie Gray. And ultimately, they were not convicted.
This was back when?
This was 20, you'd have to
2015, 16?
I want to say 15, yeah.
But was when Gray was actually killed, right?
That sounds right. But she charged not long after, I believe.
Okay.
And did not convict. But this brought her national attention, but also put a target on her back. And it would take some years, but then they looked into public corruption. But what they ended up getting her for and getting her convicted was that she bought a couple condos or houses in Florida, and or one in at least one in Florida, and she borrowed money from her husband at one point, and she said that she was suffering a COVID hardship. But they went deep into her personal loan documents, and that is how they convicted her and got her out of the public eye. And then here in DC, you have another young black elected official, Kwame Brown, who was in his late 30s, and he was DC Council Chairman, which is an extraordinarily powerful position, the second most powerful outside of mayor in DC. And he was targeted by federal investigators. They had the FBI and another agency looking for public corruption. And they clearly didn't find any public corruption. But then they started digging into his personal loan documents, and lo and behold, he had changed a 3 to an 8 on a loan document to get a larger loan. And ultimately they were able to convict him and get him thrown out of office. They also, so, and that's it. Marilyn Mosby was taken out with a headshot. Kwame Brown was taken out with a headshot. His brother, Che Brown, was also taken out with a headshot. And in court, the prosecutors noted that, well, Che Brown has worked for his brother's campaigns. And the judge was like, that cannot be what the issue is here. Like, we don't convict people for working on their brother's campaigns. And so, no, that's why they had looked into him so carefully and found anomalies in his personal loan documentation. And so what I've seen is that that there's incredible power in these prosecutors, and they seem to go after black officials with strong black support to carry out these headshots. And it's really quite a disturbing thing. And also the penalty, the 30-year penalty, I think that needs to be reduced, because there's so many people who get a little, if you start looking with a magnifying glass in their loan documentation, are susceptible to that. So that gives prosecutors just an extraordinary amount of power. And in my experience looking around here, they haven't used it equally, but problematically.
Yeah, and just to clarify what this, people might make statements about their income in order to be more presentable to a bank financial officer, and then they're under pressure to have a high income, to obviously to have the richer you are, the more the banks like you, and the less of a risk you're perceived. But of course, black homeowners attempting to build some wealth are in a double bind in many ways. So family wealth, maybe a family loan, can be used that way. And all of this is to protect the banks against so-called fraud, when of course the banks are protected because in the case of a mortgage, they own the property until the loan's paid off anyway, right? So what exactly, how are the banks actually harmed by this? Do they not make as high a profit by charging a higher interest rate from the get-go? Is that what you were saying?
I suppose the banks are harmed if you get false information, then, or faulty information, then they might their risk factor be different, and the interest rates they would charge, and so on and so forth, would be different. But I remember, like it was yesterday, sitting in the courtroom, this high-ceilinged federal courtroom, and Kwame Brown, who just days before had been the second most powerful person in D.C., suddenly looked so small, and the judge said to the prosecutor, "So the banks lost no money?" And the prosecutor said, "The bank lost no money." And I was like, "Then what are we doing here? That doesn't mean you can, fudge on your loan documents." But it is extraordinary to have had such, there was a real public investment made to get Kwame Brown. They didn't get him for public corruption, so they went deep into his personal loan documents. And to hear the judge saying, "So the bank lost no money," and the prosecutor admit, "The bank lost no money," and yet this man's political career, everything he worked for, was snatched, taken from him, and he's, you know, his political career was ruined. He's moved on, but this squares Thomas with the extraordinary career of the most corrupt ever official, Jack Evans, who is white, who's back on the DC payroll now, and the bureaucratic job. I think he's tasked, seems like he's tasked with pushing for a stadium. But if you wanted to get someone with a headshot, this was the easiest case to make, because in addition to being utterly corrupt, he was secretly taking payments from the most powerful people in DC, including the chairman of the Reserve Bank, the Richmond branch of the Federal Reserve Bank system, a parking magnate named DC named Rusty Lindner. He was taking payments from him and doing his bidding amongst the top developers in this city. In addition to that, his loan documentation was just extraordinarily suspect, and yet he was never charged with anything. Include they could they never get him with a headshot or just for his corruption. So the selective nature of who does and doesn't get prosecuted has certainly been something that has been on my radar for the last decade plus.
And to be clear, DC council members are paid effectively as a full-time salary. It's 100+ thousand a year, correct? And yet they are allowed to hold jobs outside of the council simultaneous, correct? And one of Evans's sources of power was not only his chairmanship of the Finance Committee of DC Council, but also his position, senior position. Was he a senior partner at some Tony Washington law firm?
Yeah, that's right. I think council salaries are now north of $140,000 a year. And with regards to Evans, for years he ran his corruption through the law firms where he worked. And it was impossible to get him there because he could just say, you have to disclose where you get your income. But if it's just from a law firm, you're done. And then the law firm can have all these clients. But like, what does that have to do with you? You don't have to disclose the law firm's clients. And so he worked for many years at Patton Boggs, it's now Squire Patton Boggs. And then he started working for a local firm. And that's when all of a sudden people start asking a little more questions. And then he set up a personal consultancy where it's just him. And that's when you can start tracing every client is no longer kind of hidden behind the veil of a law firm. Now he has clients at his personal law firm, at his personal consultancy that are paying him directly. And that's when you're able to connect the dots and be like, oh, this is some serious corruption. And yet he's never charged.
Pete, last question. There's currently a complex deal in the process of being made law here in D.C. That would commit the taxpayers of the district to pay up to $1 billion to support a new football stadium for the NFL franchise Washington Commanders, formerly the Washington Redskins. Word is Trump wants to restore the old name so he can brag about that. But can you tell our listeners, give an overall description of this proposed deal over a sports, arena, as well as your criticisms of the proposal and your assessment as to its likely outcome?
Well, it is likely to come to pass. This is what Mayor Bowser sees as her legacy, and the DC Council has to vote on legislation twice, but it is rare after they vote on it the first time to approve it that they'll switch. Very rare. And they've approved it the first time. You said it was $1 billion taxpayer dollars that were going to this stadium. And indeed, that is what media reports have said. They said upwards of $1 billion.
Well, that includes infrastructure improvements and various things, not just the stadium itself, but apparently there's a multi-resident and shopping complex that's in the, part of the plans as well.
That's right, but this is going to be more like $6.5 billion taxpayer dollars,
Oh.
because there is the things that you just described are right. That's going to be upfront money. DC is essentially going to make the site available, structurally ready for Josh Harris, the multi-billionaire owner of the Commanders, to construct the stadium. I think Harris is putting in $2.7 billion, but that's just the upfront money that DC is going to provide to kind of do the horizontal development, I think, whereas Josh Harris can do more of the vertical stuff. That's just peanuts. That is just the tip of the iceberg, because this is a nearly 180 acres, the last large tract of DC land that is riverfront. It's along the Anacostia. It's where the old RFK Stadium still stands. It's coming down. And that's where the Commanders, then the Redskins, played for many years. But they've been out in Landover, Maryland, 6 miles away, essentially in the middle of nowhere. They want badly to come back to DC, to be in the nation's capital. And yet, so DC has extraordinary leverage to get them back. And instead, what they've done is just open up the checkbook, not only in upfront costs, but actually the lion's share is in the tax break. So here you have nearly 180 acres, and for 30 years, Josh Harris will pay something like $2 a year rent. And so that's not just for the stadium, that's for an extraordinary expanse where he can build housing or not, where he can be this little fiefdom he will rule over, riverfront, and paying $2 a year. I can't remember all the details, but it's like $2 a year for 30 years, and then you pay market rate for a few years, and then it freezes again. And so obviously the cost of property increases, and rents go up. So to have a mechanism that freezes rent on such a vast expanse of land that is worth billions of dollars, and that's where most of the taxpayer losses will come from. So, but it was so enraging to me that it was described. First, Bowser said it was going to be $850 million in taxpayer investment. And then the Washington Post and Scar, I think out of the George Mason School, they did a poll based on the $850 million number and found, I think it was 55% support among district residents. As they're doing that poll, the Post itself admits, oh, this is going to be north of $1 billion. But they don't redo the poll. They just keep it. They get their 55% support, and they're like, majority support for the stadium. And they just keep that. They just freeze that majority support and freeze that north of $1 billion number, whatever that means, in time. And then the moment the thing passes, and it's the first council vote, so now it's almost assured the second vote. The Post admits, a columnist Mark Fisher wrote, it's actually going to be billions of bucks. I was like, where would that would have been helpful to provide when you polled district residents, helpful when you wrote about this deal in countless stories, to say it was going to be billions plural. Nothing had changed. In fact, the deal had gotten slightly better in that period. But if you look elsewhere, there's a great website, an outlet called Field of Schemes by this fellow, DeMoose. And he just covers these stadium deals across the country. And so he has extraordinary expertise on these deals. He knows how to just break it down. And he says this is far and away the most extraordinary and generous deal that a city has ever given for a stadium. So the media
What's the
reports say
reporter's name again?
Neil DeMoose, DeMause,
Okay.
and he just does excellent work. And he covered this deal thoroughly. And this is going to be an albatross that, I mean, you had a hundred. And last thing I'll say is that even the DC budget office itself, they put out a report. Oh, and by the way, there aren't many things that economists agree on, but that stadiums are a horrible investment is almost universally agreed, that this is a poor use of public dollars. Well, that was confirmed. Well, that was confirmed by the DC budget office, which the DC council had commissioned a report. And what they found was that over 30 years, if the DC council if DC put a stadium there, they would in year 30 they would make $1 billion less. Then going so they would be essentially be by just having housing, DC would bring in far more tax revenue over 30 years than if they built a stadium. And that is excluding the extraordinary taxpayer investment that is being made. So it's not a good deal for taxpayers, even if you didn't have the extraordinary public investment, which you do. It's a huge lost opportunity, but the mayors just are politicians want to do things like this. You get your name in lights, all the attention is there. It feels like you're really doing something, but it is really disturbing to see. And I should say that in Mayor Bowser's budget, she makes room for, you know, this, I think it's 500 million this year, and maybe, you know, there'll be another tranche of 500 million coming, and then the rest of the investment is in tax breaks. But as she's providing these extraordinary investments for the stadium, she's also cutting Medicaid to the most vulnerable here in DC. And one of the things that I've thought about is that you have Democrats right now who are at their lowest point in polling in 35 years. This is a party in crisis. And here you have Donald Trump as president. And what is the Republican Party doing? They are passing Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, which gives disproportionate tax breaks to the richest and seizes what little this rich, rich country provides in healthcare to the most vulnerable, knocking millions off Medicaid. And you're like, the Democrats are opposed to that, and rightfully so. But then here you have the mayor of DC and the DC council. These are all Democrats, and this is the opposition party. They're showing a different way. And what are they doing? They are taking money from the most vulnerable, taking health care, taking Medicaid, and delivering hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, ultimately billions of dollars, to a billionaire. And by the way, the owner, Josh Harris, is so tight with Trump that Trump wanted to name him his Office of Management and Budget Director in his first term. And Harris's firm, Apollo Management, provided Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law's company, with an extraordinary loan, much larger, I think three times the size that Apollo provided to other companies to help save, I think it was a Chicago building that the Kushner family was really struggling with. I think it was like over $100 million loan. And Josh Harris donates to Republicans disproportionately. And, you know, the chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, when he was running, he said, well, there are good billionaires and bad billionaires. And the good billionaires essentially are the ones that give to us. And the bad billionaires are the ones that give to the Republicans. And even by that definition, what DC is doing doesn't pass, because they're giving all this taxpayer dollars to a Republican billionaire who's tight with Trump. And this is the opposition party. And then folks want to wonder why this is the lowest point the Democratic Party has been in 35 years. It's not a pretty picture. You know, you worked at the schools, Thomas. You've been in DC a long time. Like, there's a lot of better ways to be spending billions than handing it to a Republican billionaire.
Sure. And I won't claim originality by pointing out that the Democrats and Republicans are the twin parties of capital. They work hand in glove together, even when they fight publicly against each other. But we're running out of time, so that will have to remain for another day. Pete Tucker, on behalf of Pacifica Radio listeners, thank you very much for speaking with me today. Where can listeners find more of your work?
They can check me out at fair.org and Counterpunch, and I have a Substack, so they can find me also on social media. You can check Pete Tucker, and hopefully my name will come up.
That was CRD's Thomas O'Rourke speaking to journalist Pete Tucker in part two of their discussion of DC area prosecutorial witch hunts and the pending sweetheart deal to build the NFL's Washington Commanders a new stadium at great expense to DC residents and taxpayers.
Same living thing.
That was Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, Make Me Wanna Holler. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The Navy has recently declared that they want to blow up radioactive buildings in San Francisco's shuttered Hunters Point Naval Shipyard, which is located in a black community. Dr. Ahimsa Soomchai has been testing community residents and workers and has discovered radioactive isotopes in their bodies and in the bodies of animals at the University of California, San Francisco's animal facility. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
I've actually written and published a series of articles. I've known about the strategic plan to explosively demolish buildings that are heavily contaminated and very dangerously situated on radioactive soils and concrete. But the plan became materialized in March of this year when the Navy sent out its official announcements and selected a contractor for the project. And until then, it was something that was on paper, but really hadn't been realized. So about March, they sent out the announcement that they were identifying workers and contractors to participate in the proposed explosive demolition of six buildings on Parcel G. It is part of the radiological machine apparatus at the Hunters Point shipyard. It played a key role in the World War II and the post-World War II era. Dry Dock 4, which is right north of the gantry crane, which sits on the Gunmo Pier, is one of the first dry docks, one of the original dry docks. But the Navy plans to demolish six buildings on Parcel G. When they initially announced it in March, they announced that they were going to do it over the next 6 months. They also sent out materials and posted them on their administrative site that identifies the information that was sent out to workers in no way informs them that they are potentially being exposed to radiological materials. The Navy specifically under environmental identifies lead and asbestos as being potential contaminants, but in no way do they identify and notify as they are legally required to disclose that these workers are potentially being exposed to radioactive materials.
Seems like they have a past record of trying to blow things up. The Candlestick Park, they wanted to blow that up, and that was stopped by a community protest. People said, how dare you try to blow up a stadium in a mostly black, brown community, poor community. The same here. It seems like they can't disassemble these buildings. They want to blow them up. It's hard to believe.
That's a good point. And under the National Environmental Policy Act, the Navy BROC is required to issue a environmental impact statement. That is one of the things that I pressured them about when they released their plan, that they are under the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, required to issue an environmental impact statement if they cannot say that this action will have no impacts, and obviously it will. The concern that I have, in addition to the very real impacts of having an explosive demolition of these dangerously contaminated buildings is that the Navy will move to its next phase of explosively demolishing buildings on Parcel E and Parcel E2, and we know how dangerously contaminated these buildings are. There's a building on Parcel E, the enlisted men's quarters, that is not even mapped in the Navy remediation plan or even on the base, because it's the building where the officers and Navy personnel who participated in Operations Crossroads, when they were exposed to those plutonium bombs and they came back to Hunter's Point, many of those officers stayed in this building, the enlisted men's quarters. I think that the strategic geopolitical advantages that we have, if we can mount a citywide opposition to this, is that the Hunter's Point Shipyard, the peninsula that extends east into the bay, is landlocked. They can't get stuff out unless they truck it through streets that are zoned residential, that are, you know, streets that belong to the city and county of San Francisco. So if the city does not permit them to truck this dangerous debris through residential communities, then they're stuck with it on federal property. And in my mind, that's great. They need to barge it out or boat it out the same way they got it in. You know, they don't need to truck nuclear waste that they brought in from, you know, the South Pacific after, you know, exploding a fleet of ships, you know, just to test what the effects would be. And now they want to take, you know, this waste that has accumulated in these buildings that were used as warehouses, as research labs, where materials were then dumped into landfills, and they want to haul it into our communities, and they don't even know where it's going. That's another element of the demolition plan. They can't even tell you where a waste that is clearly radiologically impacted is being disposed of.
You have been taking isotope testing of the residents of their. There has been a case of a police training facility where policemen in San Francisco were sent by Willie Brown to get trained. Their sneakers were melting because of the radioactivity in the land. There's also a University of California animal care facility there.
Yes.
And workers there have gotten isotopes in their bodies.
We have the Hunter's Point Biomonitoring Program has conducted urinary testing for elementary chemicals like arsenic and cesium and uranium, thallium, thorium, strontium. Those are some of the radioactive elements that we commonly detect. Dr. James Dahlgren participated as a grant partner with us, and we were able to give him $60,000 that he used towards the development of a advanced speciated urinary assay that was able to detect products of nuclear fission. And we have a nuclear cluster. People who are family members, former childhood residents, who, yes, do have atomic bomb residues in their bodies in high concentrations. All of the people who underwent the speciated testing have radioactive potassium, which is a, you know, byproduct of nuclear reactions. It's also naturally occurring. But we detected plutonium-244 in most of them. That was the radioisotope most commonly detected. We have a family of four who all have radioactive potassium, plutonium-244, and total uranium isotopes elevated. In the family of four, the 12-year-old boy who has a severe neurodevelopment disorder has these chemicals detected, and the senior man in the family. As you get older in the family, the concentrations are greater of these chemicals. So yes, we have been able to detect products of nuclear fission, and they are detected in current and childhood residents who are living within the half-mile perimeter of the base.
Stella Miranda, the wife of a worker, asked me in the this UC, University of California, San Francisco facility. Her husband got sick and cancer and was fighting for workers' comp. It seems like the University of California, the regents, the management here want to cover it up and are even fighting for them about their workers' compensation.
Yes, it is unfortunate that the UCSF workers are, you know, facing such opposition. The UCSF workers have the highest concentrations of manganese that we have detected. Manganese has a 100% detection frequency in shipyard soils, and the workers that we've tested in the UC compound have the highest manganese concentrations. Manganese is being detected in the air monitoring system around them. In addition to John Miranda, there are now two workers who've been diagnosed with colon cancer, and there are lung tumors and thyroid tumors that have been diagnosed.
Of course, over $1 billion was spent here in the remediation to Tetra Tech company, which now apparently has got a contract in East Palestine to clean up and do remediation and testing. And the $1 billion was wrought with fraud. Inspectors were falsifying the records. Two managers of Tetra Tech went to prison. And yet it seems that there was no investigation. There was no congressional investigation. Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, the governors, Governor Brown, Governor Newsom, there's been no investigation of who's responsible, who's being held accountable.
The Navy, Tetra Tech, these entities are just kind of part of a revolving door. The most contaminated region of the base, building 606, they were in a building that is immediately adjacent to the Triangle region, a triangular area on Parcel E that's been historically used to sort radioactive soils. The most heavily contaminated radiation was being staged there. They're in this building, there were contaminants in the drinking water, the air monitors were detecting exceedances. You know, their animals were getting sick, their animals were getting cancer, they were getting sick, they were being seen by doctors, and the health department was reassuring them, you know, that the building was safe. And I believe that you pointed out that the city attorney had signed off on the safety of the building.
Amy Brownell was employed by City and County of San Francisco as an environmental engineer.
Yes.
And she was actually being paid by Lennar.
Yes.
So a special deal with Willie Brown. And she was actually answering questions of people who wanted to buy apartments here in Hunter's Point.
Yes.
About whether or not they were safe.
Yes.
And she was giving them advice that everything was okay and she was paid for by Lennar. I mean, she was never prosecuted. There was never anyone held accountable.
That's very, very true. In fact, she was the principal speaker at a board of supervisors hearing on the situation, you know, with Building 606. Right now, that the activity that they're engaged in definitely violates the CERCLA Act, the federal Superfund law, because of a number of things that they've done. There's some basic common law violations, not informing and not disclosing workers of radiological impacts, not talking about federal OSHA requirements for people potentially exposed to ionizing radiation. You know, these are also very serious. You can't truck nuclear waste down a city street zone residential. You just can't do it, you know? Some of this is kind of simple when you think about the way it needs to be approached strategically. There are protections in city government in place that should, be able to halt this process or slow this process or at least bring the level of legal thinking and analysis.
That was Dr. Ahimsa Soomchai speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about opposing the U.S. Navy's plan to blow up radioactive buildings in the shuttered Hunters Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco.
Conversion software version 7.0, looking at life through the eyes of a tire hub. Eating seeds is a pastime activity. The toxicity of our city, of our city. Yo! Body on the wall, body on the disorder, disorder. Now, somewhere between the sacred.
That was System of a Down, Toxicity. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. On August 14th, federal workers rallied around the country against layoffs and Trump's destruction of vital government agencies. In San Francisco, a shop steward at the Bureau of Labor Statistics spoke out about what he does and why destroying the agency denies us real information about our economy.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm a steward with AFGE 2391. We represent Department of Labor employees here.
And what's going on with the cutbacks? I mean, apparently they don't believe in the Labor Department, and it's causing a lot of problems.
Yeah, it's a little different for every agency. We have a program, OFCCP, which they have basically wiped out completely. They have a couple employees still left in Dallas, but, you know, this is an important agency that they're the ones who go and look for discrimination in federal contracts. And in fact, they're the only agency that looks for discrimination against veterans. So they've completely cut them to the bone. We have Job Corps, which is just absolutely essential. That has been cut. We're trying to save it. It's going back and forth. And then a lot of programs, even with a program like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that one is somewhat safe. But what safe looks like is down by 20% people, significantly understaffed. And it's difficult. It's difficult. And they're doing all sorts of these things to crush morale. So even when they're not giving you cuts, shutting down your building, they're still making you want to quit every single day. So, yeah, the morale is low. So that's why we have events like this. Gotta bring that morale back up, fight together. You know, this is a perfect one because we have the people who rely on Social Security with actual workers who are doing the Social Security. And you hear a lot, you know, people kind of crapping on federal workers. But here, you're able to see that there are people out here that appreciate you, that need you, and it kind of gives you that energy to keep fighting.
And on MSNBC this morning, Kramer was talking about turning over the Bureau of Labor Statistics to a private company. What would that happen, I mean, if you had a private company?
Well, there are private companies right now that try to collect this data. And a private company, they're going for profit. So they're cutting corners. Measuring some things and not others. They're basically serving their client, which is Wall Street. Bureau of Labor Statistics, we are not going for profit. We're going for the best, most accurate data. So if that takes a little more training, you know, for me it took 3 years to get certified and probably about 5 years to get really going. So when they just cut 20% of my office, you had 20, 30 years of knowledge going out the door. And it was so fast, we weren't able to pass that over.
That's very valuable, that knowledge.
Exactly, and that's extremely valuable. All those years of training, there really is no way to replace that. It's absolutely terrible.
Is that part of privatization, get rid of the professionals and so that they can't do their jobs?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch of things to try to get people to even consider privatizing something like the BLS, which it really is the gold standard. Just first, you got to destroy it. You have to destroy the credibility. Like I was saying before, there actually is basically no way to fake these numbers. We got it. I'm checking it. My machine is checking it. My boss is checking it. We have regional staff that checks it. It goes to national and they check it. Then they run it through again. They're calling back the people we called. Like, did he really give you this number? There's no way. It's impossible. So maybe at some point they told the higher ups, look, you're not going to be able to fake this data. There's just no way to do it. So you discredit it. You do certain things. Maybe you appoint certain people that
make
it.
The guy that they want to appoint apparently was in the January 6th rally, and
yeah,
apparently he doesn't really have the ability to do what should be done.
I won't say much about him, but if you Google him, you'll find some interesting information. And the one thing, even you know, the unqualified, it's really just a difference in mindset. You know, our commissioners at the BLS are focusing on the data. They're completely focused on the data.
They're professionals. They're focused on the job.
And any sort of political agenda is just out the window. We don't care if it benefits one party or the other party. It's all of that, and it gets down to the culture too. So the BLS from top to bottom is, it truly is apolitical. We are focused on blocking that stuff out and just getting the most accurate data. And if it makes someone look good, then so be it. If it makes someone look bad, that's not even my thought. It's just get the most accurate data published.
But it sounds like they're unhappy with the data.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. And some of the things that they're critiquing, you know, these large adjustments, seasonal adjustments and things like that, there's a lot of things. There's things that happen in the economy. After COVID, a lot of businesses closed down. So we sample these businesses several years out in the future. And by the time we get there, half of them, they don't exist anymore. So it's hard to collect the same amount of data when the economy got wiped out during COVID. One answer to that would be to actually staff us higher and allow us to do more travel. Kind of, you know, if someone was listening to the workers doing the actual job, we have plenty of ideas how to do it. And we don't care about some expensive thing. It could be something simple. Just ask us what you need to do. Of course, we want the efficiency. We don't want to make our jobs harder or anything like that. And you know, a lot of times we're seeing if the job is harder, it's more inefficient, it's coming from the top. It's coming not just from the top of our agency, but it's coming from outside pressure. Corporations, they kind of want it one way or another.
Doge and Musk thought that they could do AI, could take over a lot of this work. Would AI work in what you do?
They've done a few kind of soft tests with it. There's some stuff going around on the internet too about how clever AI can be. It just makes up stuff. It just put it in there, ask us how, you know, can you...
Who's going to check that?
Well, it would take more time for me to run through AI and then go and look up everything. Like, is this made up? Is this real? From what I saw, it was basically worthless. Maybe somewhere there's a way to use it in a small little way, but there is absolutely no way it can replace jobs. So
you need actual human beings,
yeah,
labor.
Yeah, you need actual human beings. And the way we collect our data, you know, people don't know. People actually, like myself, have to go out business to business, talk to the owners there, talk to the people doing their accounting, and try to get them to provide this data to us. That takes a lot of, you know, giving them confidence that this data is going to be protected and secured. If you just have, you know, an email created by AI sent to them,
it's just going to respond to the email. So many emails people get.
Yeah, so it'll just be deleted. There's no chance. Pretty much how, you know, you can email, people like email a little bit. You can use the phone, but what really works is you got to show up there in person, show that you're a real human being, show your badge, give them the confidence that we are totally focused on protecting their data, and we're only using it to get the best economic picture for the nation. So I don't know what these robots are going to look like. Maybe you can make a few of them rather handsome or charismatic or something like that. I think we're way off from that, but you just can't replace a human being doing this stuff.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Good.
That was Mike, a shop steward at the Bureau of Labor Statistics in San Francisco. He spoke at a rally at the San Francisco Federal Building on August 14th. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Seltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.